Franco is pretty smart, but Franco is a child. And when it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices.
Hey guys, what's up? Welcome to Advices Radio. This is episode number 69, and I'm your host, Scott McNally. Back with us today is Victoria Felkar. Today, Victoria and I will be discussing muscle. We'll be discussing why people view muscular people the way they do, and we will be taking a special interest in female muscle because, hey, if you've grown any level of muscle, you know that people treat you differently because of it, and that conversation becomes even more complex if you happen to be a female. So we are going to discuss this topic from a social context. We're going to get a historical perspective, and we are going to hear about Victoria's personal experience as a woman that enjoys the iron and enjoys growing muscle. This is a difficult topic to discuss, but difficult is Victoria's middle name. Well, not really, but she's really good at tackling these deep cerebral conversations. I also wanted to mention that this past weekend, only two hours ago, I got back off the road having come home from the Chicago Pro coaching IFBB Pro Joe Russo and IFBB Pro Cara Trebisch into their pro debuts. They literally handle themselves like professionals, like pros, pro athletes, and it was a freaking blast. Joe even cracked the first call out. Can you believe it? And he came home with some hardware. He got sixth place. The show placed 1 through 6, which was really sweet. Cara ended up in the middle of the third call out. There were 4 call outs. So I just can't believe that she was able to step on the stage only a week ago, having been an NPC athlete, and now taking out a good slew of IFBB pros. So we already got feedback from Gary Udit. We are going to apply that stuff, which it blows my mind. The things that Gary had said were the exact things that we knew we had to work on. So I'm so happy we are on a good track. Both of them are going to go into their off seasons now. We're going to make some improvements and come back. What I wanted to mention about the show, though, well, A, I did tell you guys we were going, so I wanted to give you an update, and B, I got to meet a whole bunch of new cool people there. I talked to people that are all interested in coming on and doing podcasts with us. So my phone has a long list at this point of new ideas and cool people that will be joining us for future programs. It was really cool. I also got to connect with people I've only ever podcasted with and put faces to the voices, which was really awesome. Plus, I got to see a lot of old friends. So guys, I'm really excited to bring some new programming to you. Later this week, look forward to Dylan Armbrust, who I met this week. He will be on Blood, Sweat, and Gear with Skip and I. It's going to be really cool. I hope you guys enjoy that. And I'm not going to tell you anymore. There's more. It's coming. But it will unfold as it does. And you guys will have fun. At least I hope you have fun. I'll have fun. I know the guests will have fun. I think that means you guys will have fun too. All right, let's get to Victoria and see what she has cooking in that amazing mind of hers today. Welcome back to Advices Radio. I'm Scott McNally, and with me today, back on the microphone, is Victoria Felkar. Victoria, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me again.
I hear that you are traveling around, really, I could say just the country, but really you've been traveling around North America. How are your travels going?
They're going. I think I am settled for at least a couple weeks. That might be a lie. I don't know right now, actually. But my next, I guess, bigger travel is actually to Ireland. Ah. At the end of July, I'm speaking at the Irish Strength Institute for 2 days. And then I will be back in town, I think like the second week of August or something like that. So, yeah, I'm not quite done yet. Unfortunately, I guess I'm a bit of a nomad still, but.
Huh. Well, no kidding. It's nice to have that freedom sometimes. So it sounds like an interesting point in life. Guys, today we have Victoria with us to talk about the social aspects of muscle. This is something that we touched upon the first time that Victoria was with us on Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and myself. You know, we talked about just the background of how people view muscle, the stereotypes that are involved when you're sizing up a muscular person. And we're going to go more in depth on that today. And we are going to focus on specifically getting into the female side of that, because it's one thing to be stereotyped as, you know, a big, strong, burly male with muscle. And a lot of times that's looked at as a positive thing. But there's a lot of negative over just simplifications of what a woman is with what would be considered, you know, these masculine traits of, you know, strong muscle. So, Victoria, this is kind of a deep one on a social level when we really look at it, isn't it?
It is incredibly deep. And it's actually a topic that I use a lot, not only within my research, but also I teach a class on sociology of the body. So this is what I do usually for 4 months out of the year. But I also actually integrate it within my work in the industry, because I feel that the social conversation of muscle and muscularity is so important to not only understanding our motivations, our inhibitions, but also our methodologies we use for coaching, how we look at certain bodies, our understanding of even the physiological body, our understanding of medicine, pharmacology. All of this is influenced by sociology or the social world. But in our industry, we don't usually label it as such. And it's actually really interesting, because bodybuilding as a subculture has been heavily studied by academics. Absolutely. It's insane. When you start looking at like the critical literature on this, it has been this example that's used because it's such an interesting domain. You've got, and we'll probably get into this in the next, however long we're going to talk for, but it is just for both men and women, and just the subculture as a whole, because of how many different types of social behaviors, or conversely, social, I guess even segregation or separation that bodybuilders actually do from the norms. The whole notion of pushing the physical body, not only as it relates to how we actually perform, but how we look. This is a hugely complicated, so you guys just like me talking about the complicated things, I think, but this is a hugely complicated kind of discussion, but I'm super excited to have this, because I absolutely truly believe that this is fundamental for both men and women alike to kind of start to think about and to think critically about it. And there's probably going to be some things that we discuss that not everybody will full-heartedly agree with. And that's great. That is absolutely amazing. That's the whole point of critical discussions. But this is just, it's a cool topic. So I'm super happy that I can be here and talk to you guys about it.
Well, let's start out just kind of going back and almost recapping what we talked about on Muscle Minds, because you kind of broke down for us the history of, you know, and I guess let me put it this way. You know, there are stereotypes, and stereotypes exist in the world for a reason in a lot of cases. And a lot of the stuff, they're reactions that we have, and a lot of times we can't help it. We're kind of socially programmed to have these reactions. So if you see some big guy walking down the street, you know, you may size him up and immediately have thoughts about who this person is, knowing nothing about them, just based off of how he looks. And on Muscle Minds, you kind of explored the history of how this stereotype was created. And I know that in itself could probably be a podcast alone. It's fascinating the way that you had broken it down. And I do urge people, if they want to check that out, go back to the history of the show and listen to the other episodes that Victoria has done, specifically the Muscle Minds episodes where she spoke about this. But could you give us just kind of a brief overview of how that came to be?
Okay, I'll try to put my concise hat on right now, but
I know that's a challenge.
It is a challenge for me. It's the academic brain, but so I think one of the first places that I would almost, I guess, a preference to this is just to remember what the actual like sociology or study of society is. And essentially what we're talking about, what we're looking at, is sociology is a branch of social sciences, which is a branch of science, which really is this massive discipline or field of just looking at the ways in which society and humans interact with each other, the relationships that people have. It kind of goes into different fields around like anthropology and economics and political sciences and psychology. And so it is kind of this nebulous that looks, though, really at how knowledge or understandings of the social world are created, how they're built, and that really influences the ways in which we as humans interact with each other, interact with ourselves and our own bodies, and interact with the world around us. I know that probably sounds really kind of ambiguous, but part of, I guess, sociology really is. But on the most simplistic level, we're just looking at social interactions.
Sure.
We're just looking at the ways in which, so with the muscular body, how we as individuals look at the muscular body, whether it's our own or those in front of us, or how other people in society view the muscular body, whether it's somebody they know, somebody they don't, somebody on television, somebody, whatever, on the street. And so when we think of that hypermuscular male body, that interaction or that relationship really has been created over time. And there's such a beautiful complex history to it, as there is for the female body. But some of the things we talked about last time was this relationship between muscularity and criminality that was developed the early 1900s into the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s was really when you started to get this relationship between muscularity and masculinity and criminality. And I think one of the terms that I believe we spoke about was the idea of somatotyping, because that is something that a lot of people in our industry do know about. And that's the notion that the bodies are everybody's body, very generalized, can fit into three different categories. You're either an endomorph, a mesomorph, or an ectomorph. And now this research, as I think I spoke about, is completely bullshit. It has been completely debunked and thrown apart. But what it did is it actually, the individual who created this notion, William Sheldon, what he believed was that people's temperament or their behaviors were associated with their body size or shape. And so with muscular individuals, he placed stuff like aggression, criminal behavior, with the muscular body. And so this relationship got built. And his work was really, even though there is nothing behind it, this is literally like some, this is like the almost like bro science. It was so bad. Like it was just cherry picking information, coming up with his own data, skewing things. It's been completely debunked, completely thrown out of the kind of as a credential source of information. However, for whatever reason in fitness culture and really in pop culture, we still held on to it.
Okay.
And so that's where we kind of get this root of the muscular male body being aggressive or big, or the bigger you are, the more aggressive you are, the bigger you are, the more criminal you are. And so our brains, whether we realize it or not, we do something called, we create cognitive schemas. And so this is really, our brains make shortcuts. So when we see a certain individual, we automatically can say, hey, that's male or female. And we create those cognitive schemas based off of the kind of the underlying social perceptions that we have about that body. That person's old or young, tall or short. And often that's relative to our own understandings.
Sure.
So here's a really simple one. If you and I are standing next to each other and somebody sees us walking down the street, they, without even thinking, go, okay, male and a female. She's short. He's tall. He's muscular. Like, we don't even think about that. We just, our brains automatically are doing that. And these are cognitive schemas. Sure. And so when it comes to males and kind of this stereotype we have around the hypermuscular male body being aggressive or criminal, that's actually a cognitive schema that's been created because of these social perceptions and circumstances that we see around us. It's influenced by the ideas in movies. I mean, the buff-bodied kind of like action movie star out of the 1980s and 1990s, that, yeah, Arnold was the start of it, but you see, if you look back in time, then it was the muscular person was kind of the villain.
Interesting.
Even in Rocky, right, you see the big juicing Russian that Rocky has to go and fight. Yeah. And so we automatically put this association together. That same association has been created within the discourse around steroids. There's this automatic perception that if you take steroids, you will be hypermuscular. You will be big. But we all know that is not the case at all.
Unfortunately, you still got to work.
Exactly. So that, I don't know if that kind of, I'm trying to be as concise as I can on this one, on the little history there, but it does have this very long history. It goes back even to, I mean, the foundations of physical culture within the prison system. It goes, and I think I touched on that quite a bit in the last episode, and also the idea of why men build their bodies, what that actually gets into, and that actually kind of, I guess, curves and goes into our conversation of women and muscularity quite nicely, because usually in society, at least from a sociologist's perspective, is we often create binaries. So a binary is that lovely, awful idea of black and white thinking. So I already started to kind of do that when I was talking about the schemas. So if you and I are standing next to each other and somebody looks at us, they're creating this binary. She's a woman, man. So you've got one or the other.
Yeah.
Old or young, skinny or fat, healthy or unhealthy. And so binary thinking or binary belief systems, it's almost like our brain is standing at a fork in the road and it sees only two options and we have to pick one. And it's really difficult for our minds, unless we are able to kind of take a step back, to really think about that fork in the road and which way we want to go. And often for a lot of people, it's too late. They've already gone down one of the roads and they don't want to even think that there was another option or any other options for that matter. And so this fork in the road, I can also discuss that as like a lens we wear. We wear ideas. So when we think of, let's say, the distinction between old and young, we have certain ideas of what would classify that. So wrinkles, gray hair, let's say posture, mannerisms. We have all these different things that go into this thinking, and when we go down our routes, we don't critically think about that. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. It's a simplification that we can just kind of see something, make a decision, gloss over it, and then base our reaction almost off of those very simple split second decisions that we made, right?
Exactly. And a lot of times, binary thinking leads to quick irrational decisions and actions.
I could see that. Sure.
Because we just snap. We go, okay, yeah, female, she's weak. Males are stronger. We just, without even thinking, we use usually generalizing ideas that are shaped by the social world. Sometimes they have maybe science, and I'm going to air quote that one to shit, because science, we know, is still created by somebody. Somebody has gone into it. Empiricism is still somebody has created it. So we automatically kind of associate these certain ideas. And with the body itself, I mean, at the very core of this conversation is the ideas we have built around the male and female body, and that they are seen to be a binary. Men are associated with strength. Therefore, women are associated with weakness. Men are associated with power. Women are associated with passivity. Men have been associated with being bigger. Women are associated with being smaller. So
Let me ask you this then. So, yeah. So far, I think a lot of the way this has been seeded and a lot of what I'm picturing in my head is the way that I will stereotype someone else or the way that somebody else stereotypes me. But what about the effect that this has on the lens that we use to look at our own bodies and how that affects our identity, looking inward versus not just looking at other people, but, you know, cause I guess what I'm thinking is that, you know, these things, I think, they affect us the way other people, respond to us in the world and then the way the world treats us. Mm-hmm. But at the same time too, I feel like there's a sense of believing in these stereotypes, about ourselves. And
absolutely.
The reason I say this is because I know people. I could say I know a number of women that that do have a good amount of muscle, and that they are very concerned. You know that they don't want to be come off as masculine.
And
I think that it's something at times that they're grappling with internally. Almost, it's they want to portray themselves as they want to be seen, but they also want to see themselves as that too.
Absolutely. And that's something that I know all too well, because I've been there myself. And it was definitely a very complex conversation. So the social world affects obviously our own thinking. And our brains also can pick apart our own bodies just like we do other people's bodies, because we've associated certain ideas. We've associated muscularity with masculinity. And the best way I can go about doing this, and I'll actually maybe send you a picture that you can put up with like the show page.
Okay.
So people can kind of see this, but I want people to think about, and I'm going to pick on you, Scott, because I'm talking to you, but I want
I can handle it.
I want you just to think about somebody like two arms flexing.
Okay.
Okay. And on one side you have one arm, and yes, I'm using a binary as an example, but on one side you have a hyper muscular arm that's got bicep peaks and veins, and it's grainy and it's gritty, and all you're seeing is these two arms. Okay, so you're seeing one arm, front double bi, flexing, big muscle, peaking biceps. You see the nice low hanging tri. You've got grainy appearance and vascularity, and it's just skin splitting pump, whatever type of bro terms you want to apply.
You're such
to
a meathead. You're really getting into that description, but it's painting.
My students love when I do this because they're just like, we understand you better right now than we normally do. So that's on one side. On the other side, you still have an arm doing a front double bi and flexing, but it is smaller. You don't see any type of definition at all.
Okay.
There is maybe a tiny little bit of a bicep split, but that's about it. And that's all she got or he got. We don't know. We already, though, think about it as going, okay, the one that's smaller is usually associated with being a female. The sure. one on the hypermuscular one is usually associated with being a male. But I didn't talk about things like boobs. I didn't talk about things like facial features. I didn't talk about things like reproductive organs. I didn't talk about any of the internal structures. All I wanted people to think about was this one or the other. Our brain automatically creates these cognitive schemas. So just by simply looking at that kind of that picture of these one or the other, we start to already create ideas in our brains about what gender, what sex, personality, intelligence, maybe how they've got the either arm. Was it a sport? Was it a lifestyle? And so when we start to already start to apply these things, then we have to go, okay, where did these ideas actually come from? Why did I think that one arm was a man and one arm was a woman? Why did I think that one person was a bodybuilder and one person wasn't? Then we can get into it even more. So is one arm more masculine than the other arm?
Absolutely, in my mind, yes.
Is one more feminine? And why?
Yeah, I mean, that's automatically where I would go for sure. And even if I were to imagine the smaller arm as being a male's, I immediately think of, you know, a guy who doesn't have high test, a guy who's got the maybe high estrogen and is probably, you know, just more of a subservient person. It's just that's automatically the picture that comes to my head.
So then we have to go in one step deeper now and go, okay, so we're talking about really what we've kind of why. And usually that comes to the size of the muscle, right? That's what we're going down to, is we're going, okay, one arm has hypermuscularity, one arm doesn't. So then muscles themselves, are muscles gendered, ungendered, or are they neutral? Well, we know that muscle itself is neutral. Other than a few muscles that are associated with the sexual organs themselves, men and women have the same muscles. So is there some difference between the biceps of a man and those of a female? No.
Okay.
There is, like, at the very cellular level, no, there isn't. However, we've put size is a gendered idea, a gendered understanding. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I could picture it in my head and I could see myself fall into that. So, so then taking that to that personal level, how does this affect people? How does this affect someone's self-esteem? You know, I guess that's where I'm trying to dig further in, because we've talked, you know, off air a little bit about things like muscle dysmorphia and, you know, these senses of identity that we have based off of how we look and the how we see ourselves fitting into society.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we think about it, in the eyes of most, the more muscle a woman has, the more, quote, masculine she is. And the same, of course, true is for men. The more muscle a man has, often, the more masculine he's seen to be. Even though muscle itself, I've just said, is it's neutral, it's ungendered. So the difference, other than the possibility of size, there really is nothing there. Culturally, though, muscularity or the muscular body has almost been restricted exclusively over time to the male body. And in Western context, the more muscle a woman has, she's seen to be more masculine. So as a female myself, I know personally from self-esteem wise, it was really hard for me in my early 20s to be able to critically think about that and really tear that and tease that example apart, because I automatically thought that the more muscular I got, the more people were perceiving me to be like a man.
Yeah.
Were perceiving me to be masculine. Were perceiving me to be almost this like androgynous, like, outlaw of sorts. I didn't see that I fit in within not only the fitness subculture, but also within the social subculture. So absolutely. I think, though, if I can just take kind of like a little bit of a step back, we just for us, I hopefully can all kind of just get this really nailed down people's thinking and understandings, is that muscularity is a product of culture. It is also a product of biological possibility, meaning that we can create muscle. We can build our bodies, but that is something that's a biological possibility.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
That our biology, individual to us, allows us to build muscle. We can either choose to do it or we don't. How we see muscle on the outside is a cultural practice. And being a woman or being a man is not reducible to an internal organ, a size, a shape of a body, or really even chromosomes. We're shaped by social forces, historical, political, economic. And these have all changed and built how we perceive gender, how we perceive biology, how we perceive the natural body or the social body, and also how we create kind of inequalities or discrimination. And so that social lens is really, really, really important to kind of frame this whole conversation, because when we think about that and we think about how we view even certain, let's say, exercises, we gender certain exercises we do in the gym. Glute kickbacks are seen to be more feminine. A bench press is seen to be more masculine.
Yeah.
We think about certain, gosh, even when we think about certain posing, why does women's physique use now an open hand? Hmm. Well, it's because the open hand for a bicep flex is seen to be more feminine. It has more flow to it. It's less kind of hard looking. When we have a closed fist, it seemed to be more of a fist itself. It seemed to be a socially an aggressive statement. Hmm. So something as simple as that is still shaped by our social's understanding of what is male or female, masculine or feminine. And then we automatically go, okay, if you're a man, you do blank. If you're a woman, you do blank. Bodybuilding itself, building muscle over time, has been automatically kind of ascribed to men. Because from a social standpoint, we've said, okay, men, you need to be strong. You need to be powerful. You need to be dominant. You need to be able to be good at sports. You need to be able to run fast, jump fast, lift heavy. So going back to that binary, on the flip side, what does that mean for women?
I guess it means that they would be terrible at all those things.
They don't build muscle. Don't get strong, or else you're going to seem to be a man. Yeah. Don't get fast, or else you're going to be seen to be a man, because that binary has been created. So women that push back against the binary are ridiculed. They're discriminated against. They are absolutely isolated on a very social level. Hmm. And sometimes actually that the social level causes actual discrimination. And verbal comments get made, people's body language responds and reacts to it. And this is all a social force. And so through these kind of these cultural idealizations that we have, what it meant, like, has, what, let me rephrase that. So we do gender by just kind of playing into these ideas and these stereotypes. When women go against the norm and they try to do something that is not seen to be related to their sex, they're already setting themselves up for this degree of social isolation, discrimination.
Yeah, that makes sense completely.
There is so much on this stuff I could get into, but I don't want to get too off track here. So I'll try to flip back around over kind of into your question of more of that, how we see ourselves. So there are a lot of ideas, Western ideas, of what it means to be a female, just as there is to be a male. And unfortunately, over time, because women have seemed to be, or that the idea of the female body needs to be as small and petite and passive and weak and so on and so forth as it can, the muscular body just does not fit with that social perception.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's like at the end of the day. Now imagine if you are a female that trains hard and is a bodybuilder, what that's already going to do for you and how you view your body. If that is the social kind of foundation for really gender identity.
Yeah. I guess the thing that comes up here is I'm looking for an answer. You know, I'm looking for an answer for these, you know, for us in general, for people that do feel any type of negativity based off of stereotypes. And I suppose that one thing we could say is, just listening to, you know, what you've said so far and having a better understanding of how these stereotypes and binaries are created, then we could, I guess, intellectualize it more and let it go. What are your thoughts, though, about trying to change this?
Mm-hmm. So for me, there's a lot of different things within that answer. First and foremost, there really is no answer to this.
Yeah.
We either want to know or we think we don't know, but the reality is these are complex and difficult conversations to have. They're things that are supposed to make us feel uncomfortable because we don't have an answer. And all too often within, like, going back to that kind of that fork in the road, we want to know, do we go left or do we go right?
Yeah.
And we want to know that now. what happens if we will never get an answer, per se, of which direction to go? Hmm. What if we decide to go, you know, and just say, fuck it, and go off the beaten trail?
Yeah.
Which is what I do with my life. That's the rabbit hole, is going off the trail completely. But so really there is no kind of answer. Now, what do we need in like almost like a, what do we need in our backpack or our ideological toolbox to be able to overcome some of this?
Yeah.
I think is a greater understanding and appreciation of how the muscular body has been built over time. And I'm not talking how it's been built in the gym or through diet or training or I mean drug use, how it's been built ideologically, how it has been, how the ideas around the muscular body have been created over time. Hmm. And if we have that alone and we see how crazy and complex this whole thing has been, it makes a little bit more sense, I think, when we are not only looking at our own bodies but the bodies of others. And I am saying this purely off of conversations with other female bodybuilders or female academics that have had a hypermuscular body, and even my own experiences, and how it really helped me personally come to terms with being a hypermuscular female body and being proud of the way that I looked, regardless of how society wanted me to look or wanted me to feel about my body. When we understand these kind of ideologies or these stigmas and stereotypes and how they've been produced, only then can we break away from them, because we no longer are going to automatically play into them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm not sure what direction to go from here.
Well, I do.
Okay. Then I'm going to follow your lead.
Okay. Do you want me to start interviewing you? Because I can. I might not be as good at it as you, but I'll try. Okay, so where I would kind of go to next would just be to think about that history of female muscularity. And so I'm going to do like the Cliff Note version of this.
Okay.
But when we think about the evolution of the muscular or hypermuscular female body, we have to remember a few key points here. And that's number one. The sport, the actual sport of bodybuilding, female bodybuilding, its conception was not that long ago at all. I mean, we're talking the late 70s was the first time that the hypermuscular female body was on stage in a bodybuilding competition. There were bikini competitions before then, or like best body competitions before then, but the bodybuilding, that actual association, was not that long ago.
That makes sense. I can even think of, I've talked to people, guys say in the UK that train at gyms that have been around for several decades that still up till recently had like a no women policy.
Absolutely.
At the gym. And now that I think about it, yeah, I guess looking back at the old days, looking back at like the Eugene Sandow days, there were no women that lifted back then, were there?
No. So, but the female muscular body's actually been documented since 1783.
Okay.
So it's been there. It's just been always kind of in a different subverse subculture. It has not been out in the open. At the end of that 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, so this is around our Sandown era, strong women were there in culture, but where we were in the carnival and the circus scene. Mm. We were the strong women, and these women were often viewed to be kind of this exotic, frightening body that were still kind of this form of entertainment that people viewed, but they were the freak show. They were literally a part of the freak show.
Yeah.
Often when we go back into that kind of that early physical culture world, we have the strong men that were on the circus scene that were the main act. They were the things that everybody was coming to see, and excitement, and, you know, even Sandow's earliest performances, because his body was seen to be the Adonis, the male perfection, come and view the perfect male body. Hmm. Whereas the women were seen to be the freaks. They were part of a different stage. There were a few outliers, of course, but that active, athletic, muscular body really wasn't even embraced until around the 1920s. And the only reason why was in that period of war, so for both World War I and World War II, the women had to start doing work physical work because men are off fighting more. And so the female body actually had to now be more strong. It had to now be more powerful. It had to be able to participate in physical work. But then once World War II was over, women were sent back into the home. They were sent back to kind of be that, quote, proper housewife, to accept that traditional gender role again. And so the actual female body was not getting the same degree of, you know, just physical activity, physical fitness as it had previously. Now we kind of fast forward into the 1960s and 1970s, and we have the feminist movement happening. We have a ton of crusades for equal political structures, culture and inequalities to be broken down. And this kind of created this platform for a strong woman, both inside and out. 1977 was the first female bodybuilding contest. Those bodies, though, when we look back at pictures of them, they didn't really challenge, I would say, a lot of those accepted notions of masculinity and femininity. There was, I mean, they were still wearing heels. They were very, and I can send some links so, again, people can kind of take a look at some of this stuff, visual representations. But we think about those initial bodybuilding contests, the women really weren't kind of hugely pushing back. They were to some extent, absolutely, but not than what we see throughout the 1980s. And so throughout the 1980s, within the world of competitive bodybuilding, we see women actually like kicking off their heels in protest and starting to do poses that were associated with men. They were doing a front double bi. They were doing doing posing routines. They were doing pose downs. And there was, though, it's not like in bodybuilding this was completely accepted at all. Even within the sport of bodybuilding, there was a lot of discussion of whether or not it was okay for women to do this. I've got a couple different examples of bodybuilding magazines of, I mean, it's crazy some of the different discussions, but it was like, and I think it was an Ironman in the early 80s. And it was, I mean, one of the articles was on don't mess around with nature. And another one was we've come a long way, but are we going too far? Like those were the names of two articles on female bodybuilding.
Interesting.
And it's, I mean, you open up the first one, Don't Mess Around With Nature by, so I'm going to quote this, but I think that lifting weights for women is okay up to a point. But I think it is against nature when women try to be, get as strong as they think they can be. I think it's just about as bad to see a woman trying to get their muscles as big as they can. If nature wanted women to be super strong or to have big muscles, it would have built them with big muscles. So that's a quote. Right there, we see somebody that's kind of blurring that boundary between culture and biology.
Absolutely.
Right? Because we know nobody is born with big muscles. We create them in the gym or through sport or through other things, right? We are neutral when it comes down to muscularity, unless you get people that have like genetic mutations, and I can get into that whole world itself. But I mean, just basically here we have somebody in, I think this is 1981 or 1983. I forget which year this, that specific article is from, but that's the, I mean, that's the discourse. That's the dialogue that was happening around female bodybuilding when females were trying to start to kind of push back and actually build their bodies. And so this kind of domain of competitive bodybuilding, I mean, we're talking 30 to 40 years, and it's really faced this tumultuous cycle of struggle and like triumph and unrest. And in the 1980s, we have these bodies that at first did not kind of challenge the accepted norms of masculinity and femininity. But then we have a shift in the mid-80s, and Bev Francis is really a big part of this one. And I think many of your listeners probably know who Bev Francis is. I mean, her and her husband are iconic in our industry. But her body was hyper, like even I use that word hyper muscular, but like that's just really saying like it was jacked compared to the other women on stage. There is, so we all know pumping iron, I'm assuming listeners, everybody's probably nodding and being like, is she an idiot to even ask me that? Yeah. But there is pumping iron to the women.
Right.
There is a female pumping iron that if you have the skills and ability to find it online, watch it.
Yeah. Great movie.
It is a game changer for, I think, a lot of women if they do can get their hands on that, because it shows you a lot of these complexities back in the 1980s of not only judging criteria, but how women were, you know, told that they had to look, how they had to train, how they had to behave. So we're constantly, the female body is constantly kind of being told what to do. But I'll get into a different conversation on that maybe later, maybe not. But
and just for those who haven't seen the movie, mm-hmm. Bev Francis suffered a great deal of backlash, didn't she?
Huge, absolutely huge. Because, I mean, for her, she was a powerlifter that then transitioned into bodybuilding. And yet, female powerlifting, it's been around. But again, it was very, very small group of women that were female powerlifters, and they were really pushed to the margins of society. Female athletes, the same thing. They were pushed to the margins of society. And there was this kind of complexity, and I think a lot of female athletes still feel this today, between the bodies that are required for their sport and the bodies that society wants them to have. Those often are not the same body. And it creates a lot of complexity and tension for that individual, especially when it comes to identity creation and formation and a sense of belonging. And if you're constantly being told that the body that you need to have for your sport does not belong in society, that is going to create a massive amount of turmoil. Yeah. So Bev Francis, along with some other muscular women on the scene at the time, they kind of created this social revolution of moral panic. And people really were like, okay, well, what do we do? Because realistically, with judging criteria, yeah, she has the best bodybuilding body on stage. She's got the biggest muscles, she's got the decreased level of body fat. And so what do we do though? Do we want that body to be the body that people now are going to aspire to and to build in female bodybuilding? Do we want to try to keep it small, tight, and quote feminine? And so you see this pushback back and forth. There's a book by, and I'll send a book list, because there are a bunch of books on this that are awesome that talk about this struggle. And how, I mean, even the IFBB, the judging criteria, everything works within this. Because it does play into a huge part of how we see the muscular body and how we're able to view it. In the early 1980s into the 1990s, female bodybuilders did actually gain mainstream. I mean, we had female bodybuilders that were appearing on the cover of Playboy. We had female bodybuilders that were, I mean, female bodybuilding was broadcast on mainstream television. Yeah. So female bodybuilders really came out there and they took a stand and they built phenomenal physiques. Like, let's think of the women that were during this era. We've got, Bev Francis was iconic, but we start to have people like Kim Chavesky and Landa Murray. And these iconic female bodies that were just phenomenal, beautiful physiques that really, from a social standpoint, weren't accepted. Mm. And from a bodybuilding standpoint, they were at least more accepted than the hypermuscular female body is today. There is this little bit of a switch that we start to see. So, and this kind of also, I guess, almost covers into the relationship too of the ways our industry was created. So the backlash began when women started to be perceived that they got too big. Mm. And that then created this hostility, even within bodybuilding, against the hypermuscular female body.
Yeah.
So you see fitness get created in the early 1994, fitness
was so created that was an answer is what you're saying. Yeah, it was an answer exactly. To not have to be, you know, to not have to take it any further.
Yeah. So, you see this kind of this turning, the tables get turned and female bodybuilders then suddenly had, I guess, competition of another muscular female physique that wasn't as muscular as they were. And it was like this arena that was created for women who did not want to be that muscular to begin to compete. Mm. And it didn't come without debate. There's a huge amount of debates. I mean, there was even a discussion, and I'm not going to say who said this because I don't know if this individual is still in our industry, but they, within a magazine, they talked about how, like, essentially, like, who is sexier, a female fitness competitor or a bodybuilder? And that's like comparing like a female Olympic athlete to a Playboy bunny. Like, who has more sex appeal? And yeah. So we're putting that sex appeal, we're putting gender, we're putting femininity and muscularity into this melting pot and pinning the hypermuscular female body against just more of an athletic muscular female body. We see figure in the 1996, 1997, when it came out, also start to challenge this too, because again, it was a body that wasn't as big, as hard, as muscular, as lean. It's, and please, women, don't take offense to this because I'm on your side, but it was seen to be a body of mediocrity. It was seen to be that middle ground, and that, okay, we're not soft and small and not muscular, but we're not them. We're not that other, because that other from a monetary standpoint too was not, because it was not accepted, it was not making money for the organizations. It was not filling seats, quote, and this is not my personal belief system. I'm simply just talking about the history here. There were letters sent to competitors from different organizations telling them to stop being as muscular, take it down by 20%.
Yeah.
And competitors did that because if they didn't, they wouldn't have a stage to compete on. So I hope now we're kind of getting into our, at least when I started to get into the scene, and that's where now we have the introduction of, so I first started training in the gym in 2004, 2005. And so there were not as many classes as there are today within the competitive world of fitness, figure, bodybuilding, bikini, so on and so forth. And so that introduction of another new class and another new class and another new class creates even this rift within our industry for what bodies we like, don't like, are accepted, are not accepted, are seen to be feminine, are seen to be not. So bikini came onto the scene, at least within the IFBB, and that now created another new body for women to create. And women's physique came on, and I think we all know the reasons behind why women's physique was brought on. And then all of a sudden, female bodybuilders disappear completely. They're gone.
It's funny because I feel like physique is becoming the new female bodybuilding. It's just, it's relabeled, rebranded, but every year the girls are getting, you know, bigger and better and harder and grainier. They're pushing it closer.
If we go to like one of my favorite like terms or that goes with this is what goes around, goes around. We're just going to see a cycle. This is always a cycle. We see it going around and around and around. And it's in a cycle of insanity because it really, nothing new is ever actually new. We see bodies that get built, women take, you know, they do it and they do it just as well as the men are doing it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, no, you've gone too far. Let's bring her back a bit. Let's bring it back a notch. And then, okay, now we've got to figure out some way to reboot. So let's introduce something new. Okay, we reintroduce something new. Let's get rid of the old. Now in with the new. And, oh, women are starting to get really good at this again. Oh no, we gotta get it to bring it back. Let's introduce something new. Yeah. And you see this cycle going and going and going. And that's because, like, at the end of the day, we're creating the bodies that we want, the bodies that we feel are really indicative of what bodybuilding is and what bodybuilding is. I think if we going to just break it out, let me interview you, Scott.
Okay. Let's turn it around here.
Let's take sex and gender. Let's take all that kind of social shit out for a second.
Okay.
And so what different criteria or even just, you can just say words, make up a good bodybuilding physique? What do you want to see? What type of, like, judging criteria, what do you want to see?
I mean, obviously muscular development, shape, you know, which is going to be genetic, but, you know, I want, you know, good bodybuilder is going to have good shape to the muscle. Conditioning, you know, is going to be right up there too. And those are going to be the main things I'm looking for, really, you know, shape, conditioning, and muscularity. Absolutely. Okay. So, and that's not women or men, you know, just in general, right?
It's just in general, right? We took away all the social stuff. So let's break down conditioning. What's conditioning to you? What does that mean?
That means low body fat, you know, tight skin, and, you know, little water retention.
Which means vascularity.
Absolutely. And graininess.
Which means graininess. Okay. And so right now we just created some, actually literally wrote notes as you were talking, but we just created like the judging criteria of what would be associated with a muscular, hypermuscular physique. Is that what is wanted for females right now? No.
Yeah, no. I mean, but the funny thing is that I do feel that the girls that are, that carry those traits are still the girls that are winning the shows in physique.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But let's think where physique started and let's think of where it is right now. It's changed a lot in the last couple of years.
It has. I can think of when it started, they were going for girls that were almost just too soft, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm,
And it has continued to develop. The girls have gotten bigger as it's gotten more competitive. Mm-hmm. Shoot, we can even talk about the bikini division. Mm-hmm. It's funny, as we speak here, you know, I mentioned I have a client doing Universe. She's in her hotel room right now, and I had to feed her up. First of all, we wanted to get her full and round. But second of all, she had veins across all of her abs. And we know the judges don't want to see that. You know, I was talking about this with somebody last night. You know, they're saying that it's just too much. That's too hard for this look. And you have to dial that back. In my opinion, I think it would be cool as hell if the bikini girls could be just as hard and dry, you know, as any other division. That would be badass to me.
Yeah. And like, but let's like, again, like you just nailed it, because it's like, that's too much. It's always seemed to be too much, right? And right. So, like, yes, we're talking about actual criteria here, but like, we have microcosms in society, and really, like, this idea of women being too much if they're too veiny, women being too much if they're too hard, women being too much if they're too muscular, even if it is within a competitive criteria. Like, if we strip that away, that's really society. Women are still seen too much vein is not good for society standards.
Yeah.
Too much muscularity is not good for society standards. And so, like, if we start to strip away now out of the context of actual bodybuilding, within mainstream pop culture, yes, female muscularity has gained huge shift within the last 5 to 7 to 5 years. Absolutely huge. But there's still this kind of, you can't be too much. You can't be too big, or else you're a freak. You can't be too veiny, or else you're a freak. You can't be too hard, or else you're a freak. You can't not have any muscle anymore, because now you're not sexy, since apparently fit is the new sexy or some bullshit like that. But there's always this too much, too little. And what's that? That's a binary. And so when bodies are in the middle, like I said at the very beginning, when we're in the middle, when we choose not to be one or the other, it is an uncertain place to be. You're embracing the unknown. You're in this kind of murky water. And we're constantly, as humans, we want to be accepted. We want to belong. That's a human need, is belong, a sense of belonging. And so if, as a female, you don't feel like you belong in the social world, that is scary. As a female, hypermuscular female, now you don't feel like you belong in even the subculture of bodybuilding. That is terrifying. Yeah. So you better build up either a bunch of like emotional armor, because you're essentially going to war every single day, or you got to start critically thinking and being able to break down a lot of these perceptions, so you know why people think that you're too much or too this or too that. And now that's like I said, that's in your backpack. That's in your coping backpack. So you can then kind of build your own sense of belonging, because your own sense of belonging is what's going to be able to combat that sense of social, really just not belonging.
So I guess at the end of the day, it still comes down to you to define who you are to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, I can use an example of like, so when I started lifting, I was pre-DLB era in the gym. And I think women, if you have been lifting, they probably understand exactly what I'm talking about. Because before DLB really did, she was a game changer for the hypermuscular female body, because around that time that she was kind of creating the brand, the Flag Norfail brand, was around the same time that we started to see more and more muscular women gaining kind of mainstream again. We see them appearing on the covers of certain magazines. Like, you go back and you can do, and anybody, like, I really, really, if you want to kind of get your geek on and become a little researcher, go through and start looking at bodybuilding magazines, let's say from the 1980s through to today, and just count how many women you see in them. Take a look at the size and the shapes of the bodies. See who's on the front covers. How many times has a muscular female been on the front cover of a mainstream bodybuilding magazine? And are they kind of not really muscular, or are they posed like incredibly sexually, or are they kind of just hanging off some dude's biceps? How many times have we seen a female body flexing just like a male body on the cover of a mainstream magazine?
I can't think of a single time, actually.
Exactly. Why? Because it's being seen and it's being labeled, it's being defined as not being marketable. What makes up a marketable body? A body that is desired, a body that belongs, a body that is seen to be associated with things like sexual, like, well, just sexuality. Sex sells, we know that. But if we've already labeled socially a body as not being sexy, not being attractive, not being feminine, it's not going to be on that cover. DLB helped to kind of create a shift or a rift because of the ways in which like her and Rob branded herself as not being this hypersexualized body, but being kind of almost like subvertly sexual with the ways that she presented herself, and that it was more of this like, let's put strength and good training and, you know, more of this hardcore feel to it. And then all of a sudden, like for me, pre-DLB, like I was the only woman training in the weight room. Like, I was always only the only woman. I would literally get stopped in the middle of my workout and be told things like, why do you want to build big muscles? Like, you're going to get too big. You're going to get bulky. Yeah. Are you trying to train like a man? Are you trying to look like one of those bodybuilder chicks? You're really strong for a girl.
Yeah.
Be careful. You don't want to get too big.
Yeah.
I remember dating in my early 20s and it was awful. It was traumatizing because I would have guys on like first dates be like, yeah, you're really like jacked, but I just want to know, like, are you wanting to get bigger?
Oh.
And like, I'd be like, fuck you, asshole. Like,
you look good the way you are now, but yeah.
But just don't go anymore. And so, like, as a strong muscular female body, like, I did get used to the looks and the jeers and all of that stuff, because for me, training was way more important to me than that bullshit. And so I kind of was able to put my, literally put my blinders on and keep training. And that's what kept me in the gym. But it was difficult. And it was difficult because you don't even, like, you're in this environment that is pretty much telling you that, like, you can't push yourself how hard you want to. You can't look how much you want, or look the way that you want to, or you think is awesome, or you can't. It's just this sense of honestly just constantly not belonging. And like, I mean, even when I'd be lying if I said that wasn't an easy process. I remember one time, I think we talked about this before, Scott, that I was in my early 20s, and so I was in my undergrad. I just started taking some courses on like critical sociology, and I was actually going into the literature on female bodybuilding, and the literature from an academic standpoint is awful and traumatizing because they made me feel bad for like wearing makeup, because that was seen to be like me following social norms of what femininity now was supposed to be. If I had I had my boobs done, oh no, that's awful. You know, if you're going to transgress these norms and be this kind of strong, powerful female, you got to do it and not be like kind of subordinated by the popular culture ideas of, you know, femininity. You can't have your hair long and you can't do this and you can't do that. And I was like, oh my God, this is killing my gains, because I don't even like lifting right now because I'm constantly questioning everything.
So yeah, you had to be torn then.
Yeah. And so I actually was like, I remember I was training at this very, very, very mainstream gym And I used to have to train like during the power hour because I went to school all day and I'd come home and sometimes I would just go straight into the gym like from school. Yeah. And so I went in one day and I'm like, I'm going to do my own little social experiment. And so one day I went in and I was wearing makeup because I just come from school and I had my hair was like somewhat still looking slightly feminine. I had my bangs down, which I normally like cannot stand training. Anybody that trains with their hair down, I have no idea how because like sweaty hair is the worst. And when it sticks to you when you're training hard, it is like the worst feeling to, in my opinion.
I can imagine.
So my bangs were down, my hair was up in a bun that was like more presentable. And I wore what I called like girlier fitness attire. So I was wearing like a pair of like Lululemon shorts that were like, I think pink or purple or something like that, which I never do. And an actual like form fitting shirt. And I was like, I'm still going to go in and I'm going to train, though still hard. And I want to see how people respond to me.
Yeah.
How the dudes do.
You probably didn't get, you probably didn't get done with your workout, I'm guessing.
No, not at all. And I had somebody, that was the day somebody asked me if they could spot my RDL.
Okay.
And I was like, what, huh? Totally over my head. But it was really fascinating for me because I kept getting hit on. And nobody was commenting on how heavy I was lifting. Yeah. And I still went through like a ringer. I was training with Meadows at the time. And I still went through like a ringer of a leg day. And I was constantly, somebody asked me if they could help me unload my plates off the leg press.
Look at that. So there were like, some advantages then.
I know. I was like, damn, okay. Well, this is really interesting. So then what I did the next week, the same. So then I'm like, I'm going to retest the same day that, like with a leg workout again. And I'm same time next week. But I'm going to go in and I'm going to like literally wear what I normally wear when I train. So I'm going to have my baseball hat on. I'm going to have like pretty much make mascara over my face. Like I don't even care how I look. I wear like still to this day, like men's large t-shirts to the gym because that's just comfortable for me. And I'm going to go in and I'm going to see how people respond to me. And so we had people questioning me. Are you wanting to get bigger? Why do you want to get bigger? You look fine the way you are. Are you sure you can lift that? Why do you think that this is something that like you want to do? And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, get big, get bulky, put more muscle on. And I'm like, cause this is me, this is my life. And for the most part though, I was just ignored. Like I just, nobody hit on me. Nobody, like it was jeers, looks, that type of thing, but they weren't like sexualized at all. And I was like, this is fucked up. So then I went and I started like looking into the research on this, and that's when I kind of was like, okay, for me personally, I have to remember that like at the end of the day, I love training hard. I love it. I really don't care the ways people perceive me when I'm in my zone and I'm in my element, because that doesn't matter to me as long as I get to do what I want to do and I get to train how I want to train. And this is not within the world that's going to be judged. Like when we think about female, like competitive female body sports as a whole, you're being judged. So you have to follow the criteria, right? If you want to excel, you got criteria you got to follow.
Yeah.
So that's a different than you just training for you. That's totally different. Because for me personally, like I know the body that I like to build. That's my body and I'm sticking to that. And that's one of the reasons why like I don't compete is I like a certain, for myself personally, physique that doesn't fit in any of the categories that are what's judged or presented on stage. So because I also like to do with, I'm a competitive human being, I like to be able to win, and that body would not win in any of the classes that are currently available. So therefore I just don't, because for me, my body is my body and I want to create it however I want to. That type of armor though, and that type of perception has taken me well over a decade to build up. Because again, there's always been this strong opinion of what a female body should look like.
Yeah. I think that what you're talking about, the process you've gone through, I guess I'm hoping that, you know, that if we can do anything with education, with the podcast, that possibly it could potentially open, you know, the doors a little bit for anybody out there who is grappling with that. Cause I feel like it's an ongoing thing of, you know, coming to terms with who you are and who you want to be versus what society wants you to be. And I guess, yeah, I guess that I hope that what you've shared today could be helpful to, you know, some of the women out there, especially.
Yeah. Well, and I think even for men, too, because when we think about it, these ideas of like the female body being ridiculed and stereotyped and judged, the male body is the same thing. Male bodybuilders have certain associations stuck to them, right? Like a body that blurs what is socially acceptable.
Absolutely.
Makes people uncomfortable because go back to that fork in the road. People like binaries. They like being able to easily choose one or the other. And if your body is not something that can be easily judged with our cognitive schemas or our blinders and just go, hey, yeah, one or this. We go into and we get things like, you know what, that person's a steroid user. They're a freak. They're aggressive. They're dumb.
Yeah.
We have these stigmas we've attached to bodies. And female bodies have been stigmatized. Female bodybuilders or hypermuscular bodies and hypermuscular male bodies have been stigmatized. And I think I talked about this last time with that whole notion of muscular profiling. And that, like, we view muscle just like we do age, race, ability, gender. Muscularity is what is it's a signifier. It is a signifier that has been like a lens that we view bodies now. And because we've created schemas, because we've created these ideas and these social perceptions, that then opens the ground up for stigma, stereotyping, preconceived notions of what your body means to the social world. And just because women have a hard time does not mean that men don't have a hard time too. Men still have a hard time. And I think, like, I mean, last time we talked about this in detail, but when it comes to kind of like more of an acceptance, female bodies definitely have it a lot harder. Arnold did wonders for bodybuilding, but really wonders for the male hypermuscular body. He opened the door for cultural acceptance of a hypermuscular male body with him being in mainstream culture, mainstream representations. After Arnold, you start to see other hypermuscular male bodies as mainstream representations. And when we think about this evolution of classes within certain bodybuilding federations, those also for men have happened. We have new classes for men with lightly muscular physiques. We have guys that no longer are sponsored by major companies because they got rid of their pro bodybuilders and brought in smaller fitness but male physiques. We don't see certain bodies of the hypermuscular male body in mainstream publications anymore. We see a lightly more athletic physique.
Yeah.
So just as much as we've seen this kind of evolution of female bodybuilding, we've also seen a huge evolution of male bodybuilding. And the social world is so important to this. So important to this. And if we go one layer even more, consumerism and commercialization is a huge part of this because it does come back to what we are and what we are doing is a part of a consumer society, and money means everything.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I much appreciate you coming on to spend this time just trying to help us unravel this, because whether we realize it or not, these schemas are all things that we do play out in our heads.
Absolutely.
You know, unintentionally. I think that just better understanding where these things come from could help us to potentially at least stop that, you know, arrest that process and say, hey, okay, this is what I'm thinking. But just because I had this reaction doesn't mean, you know, that this is as black and white or as, you know, left or right as my brain might want me to think of it as.
Yeah. So. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you, Scott, some links to post. And I don't know where you want to post these, but there are some videos that are really interesting. I think that some of your listeners might get a kick out of.
Okay.
One of them is called, it's amazing. It's called the 90-pound weakling. It's a phenomenal, it's by the National Film Board of Canada. But it's from the 1950s, and it's got actually a clip within it about 7 minutes in of Weider talking about bodybuilding, and it's all about making the body. And he's talking about these criteria of like what male bodybuilding is. And he actually goes into this like discussion of like, well, you know, women can't actually build muscle. Like women physiologically cannot build muscle. And of course we know he was brilliant. He knew women could build muscle, but because he knew the social world was not okay with women building muscle.
Yeah.
If you were to say, and if you were to say that out loud and be like, he'd be like, well, yeah, if you use reader systems, women are going to build massive muscles.
Yeah.
Women aren't going to buy that.
No, absolutely not.
So that whole, even like, I mean, this goes back into the commercialization of the industry and snake oil salesmen and like of the night, like the turn of the century selling certain products and the whole notion of muscle bound, like the history of muscle is huge. It is a massive, massive, beautiful area. I think that your listeners, if they kind of can start to go get into that and think about it, it's actually, it will make, I think, your sense of belonging so much easier to find, because you'll see that men and women, the muscular body has so much more than just like, you know, the dumb jock stereotype or stigma that society's applied, or the steroid user or the freaks, that there is so much more to it. So I'll send you that link. There's also Vice Sports recently did a series on bodybuilding.
Ooh.
I think there's three or four. So there's actually one within the series called The Last of the Iron Sisters. And it is available on their Vice's YouTube channel.
Nice.
And so that's also really interesting because it follows female bodybuilding at one of the, what is it? What was one of those? The only organizer or one of the only kind of promoters right now for female bodybuilding is
Wings of Strength.
Thank you. Okay. One of the shows for Wings of Strength. And then I'll also send you some links for some books. So there is a awesome independent historian named David Chapman. He's in Seattle. He is like one of my favorite historians out there because he's actually got the largest independent collection of physical culture material.
Huh.
And so he's put out a bunch of books, pictorial kind of coffee table books. One of them is called Venus with Biceps, and it is a pictorial history of female muscularity. Women, if you are challenged by the social norms and ideas around muscularity, get this book.
Hmm.
And yes, it is a plug because I love David and my boss actually wrote the introduction, but it is, that book will give you that sense of belonging within the first 5-10 pages of it.
Okay.
Because you will see that you are not alone in your pursuit, and that women have been challenged and are also challenging this kind of status quo since the 1700s.
Hmm.
There is one called American Hunks or Hulks, Hulk, sorry, American Hulks, and then International. Those are two ones on men. Phenomenal too. Absolutely phenomenal, because these are the pictures that you don't see within like the history of our sport, but that are the history of muscularity. So they're very, very, very awesome. They're not even reads, they're picture books, but just super, super cool to start to see where and how muscular bodies have been sexualized, because they have muscle and sex are inextricably linked, but also acceptance, how certain bodies became more accepted, how certain bodies became more ridiculed, because they've got things like advertisements all the way to just like some of the circus performers to some of the discussions. So it's really, really kind of great examples and ideas. And then there is anybody who is traveling to Austin, Texas, there is the Stark Center for Physical Culture at the University of Texas in Austin. And that is the largest physical culture archives and museum. And Jan and Terry Todd, if anybody is fans of powerlifting or strong man and strong woman, will know the Todds. They are like absolute godfathers in that arena, and they run it. So they are both professors with the University of Texas. Terry was Jan was actually the strongest woman at one point. And so that is open to the public, but that is amazing. Oh my God. I will send you guys a video. I like salivate watching this because of what they have. They actually, all of the Weider archive was donated.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So they've got everything there. They've got ancient statues. So they actually have the history of strength sports, weight training, bodybuilding, weightlifting at the museum. There's also a public archives. There's a private archives. They've also partnered with Rogue and done a bunch of documentary series. Huh. So they've done one on the history of Eugene Sandow. And it's not your cheap, it's high money went into making these movies. So going to kind of what we talked about is like what I think can start to help us create answers is learning that history and being critical. So I said what's kind of the definition of sociology, but like it's what's called a critical socio-historical lens. And if you can start to develop that, you will see the world and see the sport of bodybuilding in a different way. And that will open your eyes to the possibilities as well as why certain inequalities exist. And I truly believe that if you can start to men and women develop that, it will change our industry for the better.
Excellent. Well, what I will do is, since we can't post hyperlinks that you can click on through our Instagram page, guys, I'm going to post up Victoria's links over on the Advices Radio Facebook page, as well as on my personal Facebook when I share this post. Victoria, let everybody know where they can reach you. Where can they find more from you if they want to find more Victoria Felker?
I always hate plugging myself, you know that. So you guys can find me at social media. So my Instagram is just Victoria Felker. I'm nice and boring. My my Facebook is also the same, Victoria Felker. And my website is also the same, victoriafelker.com.
You have one of those names. It's unique enough that you could get your own name as a .com. I have to imagine there's a lot of Scott McNally's out there. That would be a much tougher one, but it works. Definitely. I would definitely go with a scottmcnally.com if I could get it. So you lucked out. That's what I'm thinking.
I totally lucked out, especially because like AR Felkers are not common. I think my family is literally the only ARs. So I was good there. I am going to, though, also put it out to your listeners of a amazing, amazing event that is coming up that I will be speaking at. And I cannot say enough how amazing Swiss 2018 is going to be. Swiss is a three-day symposium in Toronto that is literally like the highlight, in my opinion, of my calendar for this year, and probably it's every other year, the years to come. So if you don't get 2018, you're not going to be able to see Swiss until 2020. But it is the massive kind of meeting of weight training, bodybuilding, powerlifting, rehabilitation, injury prevention, and like specialists all under one schedule or roof. And so there's multiple different streams of, so it's just like an academic conference that you can kind of choose which streams happen at the same time. You can kind of go in and out of certain talks, but there's, I think, 30 to 40 different presenters. You've got guys like John Meadows, Dave Tate, Eric Serrano, Bill Kazmaier, Ed Cohen, Mindy O'Brien, Christian Thibodeau, Matt Wenning, Jim Wendler, Scott Stevenson's going to be there. I'm going to be there. I could just go on and on. Like the amount of people that are presenting at this is amazing. There is actually going to be an entire panel this year on hormones.
Nice.
And you're not just having like the, you don't just have to listen to me. You don't even have to listen to me. But I mean, you got Dr. Mario Pasquale, So he doesn't talk about, he's one of one of the amazing brains within this whole world that was one of the forerunners that does not do presentations or talks often. There is another steroid panel that's going to take place. So open room discussion about the iron elephant, that there will be doctors and researchers and legal. So Rick Collins will be there. So like for just example, Dr. Pasquale will be talking about insulin. Eric Serrano will talk about everything you wanted to know about testosterone, but were too afraid to ask. Stan Efferding will be talking about the vertical diet. William Leuven will be talking about steroids, SARMs, and other performance-enhancing substances, what you need to know and what you should forget. Rick Collins will be talking about fitness and performance-enhancing drug laws. Dr. Silverman will be talking about his hormonal dysregulation due to toxicity. David Sandler will be talking about the kind of the alternatives to anabolics. Dr. Willoughby will be talking about hormonal-altering substances. Doug Carpiano will be talking about hormonal micronutrient lab testing. I'll be talking about both birth control and anabolics for women. So you've got, I mean, just for that stream alone, you've got some powerhouses that are going to be presenting. So I would love it if I could see all you guys up there at Swiss. It's in October. But if you are interested in going, I actually do have a discount code.
Oh, really? What's the code?
I'm just literally scrolling through my text messages to find it.
Nice.
I think it is just V Felker, but you can find more information about Swiss at www.swiss2018.com. And if I wasn't so passionate about it, I probably wouldn't plug it because I hate plugging stuff.
Sure.
But this really is one of those events that I truly believe has so much important knowledge that's going to be disseminated over the course of 3 days. And you get to hang out with some icons because of the environment that Swiss has. It's not like presenters go to their room afterwards. Like, you're literally going to lunch, going to dinner, stopping and talking at the hotel bar in the lobby with some of the icon and influencers when it comes down to not only the people that built certain kind of disciplines like powerlifting, bodybuilding, power and strength sports, but also the knowledge holders. And you can walk up to somebody and just ask them a question and they will be more than happy to sit down and talk to you about it. And that really does not exist anywhere else in any different form. So my discount code is Swiss, so SWIS 2018-Felkar. And that gives you $45 off registration. And right now, I believe we are still on the early bird, which is ridiculously cheap.
Okay.
Like, it is, I think the cost of it is like a couple hundred bucks, like for 3 days of ongoing education. So you can save $600 or so if you register sooner than later.
Excellent. Yeah. It looked like a great event last year. I saw a lot of the video and stuff. I heard everything from Scott and from you. It seems like a really cool event. I'm sure this year will be great. I know you said you're also going out to Ireland for anybody who happens to be out there. What's the date on that?
That is a good question. I think it's the 28th and 29th, and it's at the Irish Strength Institute in Dublin. And that is put on by the Irish Strength Institute, and it's just called ISI Symposium 2018. And there is a lot of awesome presenters. Eric Serrano will be there. Ken Kanakin. So Ken Kanakin actually puts on Swiss, but he's going to be speaking there. There is a bunch of other powerhouses also speaking, and that has the same format. So like three different lectures going on simultaneously. So you kind of get to choose which one you want to go and watch. And yes, that is the 27th. So the Friday is going to start, but then you got the 28th and 29th of July.
Okay. So that's coming right up for everybody out there. Anything else coming up we should know about? I mean, that's an awful lot, but
my doctoral exams. that's it for me for right now for traveling. I still do seminars when they come up, and when people want me to come talk, I'm always more than happy to. I just only have two booked right now. So
awesome.
That's all I got for you.
All right. Well, cool. Thank you for being with us, Victoria. It's always great. It's a pleasure to have you back on.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Guys, for Advices Radio, I'm Scott McNally with Victoria Felkar. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. But no more apologies.
Voices Radio Network.